Good morning, church. Hope you're doing well this morning. My name is Ben Banta, and I'm involved here in the men's ministry, and then our family is also involved in a life group. Join me this morning. We're going to be reading out of John, from John 13, 1 through 20. It says, "Now before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come to depart out of this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. During supper, when the devil had already put it into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands and that he had come from God, was going back to God, rose from supper. He laid aside his outer garments and, taking a towel, tied it around his waist. Then he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel that was wrapped around him. He came to Simon Peter, who said to him, 'Lord, do you wash my feet?' Jesus answered him, 'What I am doing you do not understand now, but afterward you will understand.' Peter said to him, 'You shall never wash my feet.' Jesus answered him, 'If I do not wash you, you have no share with me.' Simon Peter said to him, 'Lord, not my feet only, but also my hands and my head.' Jesus said to him, 'The one who is bathed does not need to wash except for his feet, but is completely clean. And you are clean, but not every one of you.' For he knew who was to betray him. That was why he said, 'Not all of you are clean.' When he had washed their feet and put on his outer garments and resumed his place, he said to them, 'Do you understand what I have done to you? You call me teacher and Lord, and you are right, for so I am. If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example that you also should do just as I have done to you. Truly, truly, I say to you, a servant is no greater than his master, nor is a messenger greater than the one who sent him. If you know these things, blessed are you if you do them. I am not speaking of all of you. I know whom I have chosen, but the scripture will be fulfilled: he who ate my bread has lifted his heel against me. I am telling you this now, before it takes place, that when it does take place, you may believe that I am he. Truly, truly, I say to you, whoever receives the one I send receives me, and whoever receives me receives the one who sent me.'"
Thanks, man. "We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. The preamble to the Constitution sets us up for everything that is about to follow. It's this really dense and rich opening paragraph that prepares us to give us the reason for all that is to come, the purpose for it, the significance, the value of all that comes after this. The American people gathered together to create this document, to give us instruction as to how do we make decisions, what is power, what does authority look like, to accomplish what it says in the very beginning, to form a more perfect union, to establish justice, ensure domestic peace, provide for defense, promote welfare, ensure the blessings of liberty for ourselves and all those who come after it. This opening paragraph sets us up for everything that is about to come. John chapter 13 begins with a sort of preamble, a really rich, really dense opening paragraph that sets us up for everything that is about to follow. This comes at a really pivotal time in Jesus' ministry. He is transitioning from his public ministry to now this private time he has with his disciples. He's been speaking to the masses, but now the way that he speaks is just to those who are following him, giving instruction as to what he's about to do, the purpose behind it, and what life will look like following him. And the way that that transition is bridged is with a bit of a preamble. We jump ahead in the week. We were on Palm Sunday to now going to Thursday, going into Friday night of Holy Week. And Jesus is with his disciples, and John begins by giving us a bit of a recap, giving us everything that we've seen before, but it's not just saying this is what's happened, it's telling us this is on Jesus' mind. This is the setting. This is what's going on. This is what is giving definition and purpose to what we're about to see Jesus do. It tells us that all of this is happening before the Feast of the Passover. Tick tock, tick tock. And Jesus knows his hour is coming, knows that death is about to come for him. He knows that he has loved his own from eternity past and will continue to do so for eternity forward. Knows that Judas is about to betray him. Knows that he has been given all things from God. Knows that he is going back to God in glory. It's setting us up. It's giving us all this rich, dense definition so that when we see Jesus act, we should be able to say, oh, that's why. That's what was on his mind. That's what drives him to do this action. What he is thinking about, what's going on in his head, is he knows Passover's coming. He knows his death is coming. He knows he has loved his own. He knows betrayal is coming. He knows that God has given him all things. He knows that he is going back to God. He knows that glory is coming. And so what does he do? Well, he gets up from the table. Wait, that's it? That's a bit of a drop-off. I mean, we have this really dense couple sentences, and then it's just, and then Jesus gets up. It feels like a bit of an anticlimax. I mean, imagine if the preamble to the Constitution was just followed up by a few simple words of, here's all that we seek to do with this document, and so Americans be good. I mean, it feels like it wouldn't live up to what was said before. It feels like a bit of an anticlimax. But that's not what's going on. Because we are being clued into what's on Jesus' mind, it ought to make it all the more significant what he is about to do. All of this is in Jesus' head. All of this is the plan. All of this is what he knows. And so it should highlight the fact that what he chooses to do is of such significance. And what he chooses to do is wash the disciples' feet. And this seems to make no sense. It's a bit of a continuation from the end of chapter 12 where we saw quite a few paradox in that section. Jesus was just exalted as the king of Israel. Here he has finally come to kick out all the foreigners when it actually turns out he's the king of the world, come to bring in the foreigners. Jesus just said that his hour of glory is coming, and we say, yes, we just saw him exalted finally as a king. We've been waiting all of the book of John for people to see Jesus for who he is. And then Jesus says, well, actually, the way that you see who I am is when I go to a cross, when I die. And he says, those who seek to follow me, those who seek to have eternal life, well, the way that that happens is if you lose your life. We go back to John 12, verse 25. It says, whoever loves his life loses it, and whoever hates his life in this world will keep it for eternal life. If anyone serves me, he must follow me. And where I am, there will my servant be also. If anyone serves me, the Father will honor him. Jesus continues this idea of a paradox of those who are great or those who serve, those who have life or those who give it up, those who are exalted or those who lower themselves by doing that very same thing in this story. He puts this paradox on full display for us. As here is the king of the world. Here is this one who is master of all, this one deserving of all glory, honor, and praise, and what he does with it is he lowers himself. He humbles himself, and he serves others. We see this in the attire he puts on. We're given detail as to what it is that he's wearing, and it goes down to essentially the bare minimum of clothing, but there's significance in that. It would have been seen as the common attire of a servant. Here is this one who's been robed from eternity in splendor and glory, but now dressed as a common household servant. But he doesn't stop there. He begins to wash the disciples' feet. We talked a few weeks ago about feet when Jesus had his anointed by Mary. Feet were gross. There is the physical disgust that came from it as people walked around everywhere in dirt and other things in sandals all the time. But then you have the taboo aspect as well, that feet were just something that you didn't touch on another person. It was considered to be the mark of a bad master to force his servants to wash his feet. And yet here is Jesus, the Lord of Lords, the master of all, who doesn't require his feet to be washed, but who lowers himself to wash the feet of others, who humbles himself to do this lowly act of service for his disciples. I mean, we get a picture of the scandal of it in Peter's response in verse 8. Peter said to him, "You shall never wash my feet." I mean, this is not the way that this works. How can you, this one who deserves all glory, this one who deserves all honor, who's so worthy of praise, be the one to wash my feet? That's not how this works. No, I should be the one that goes low. I should be the one who's humbled. I should be serving you. You're the one who's deserving of it. You're the one who has earned it. How can you possibly do for me? No, that's not how this works. But Jesus continues, still in verse 8. Jesus answered him, "If I do not wash you, you have no share with me." But Jesus says, if I do not do this service for you, if I do not humble myself, if I do not serve you in this way, well, you have no part with me. If I'm not the one who's lowered in this time to elevate you, well, then you are not joined to me at all. See, in all the things that Jesus could have chose to do with this time, with all that preamble setting us up for what Jesus is doing, all of that preamble telling us what's going on in Jesus' mind, but Jesus chooses this particular illustration for a reason. Because in it, he shows the very thing that is true for all of his disciples, the very thing that is true for all who follow him, that Jesus is the one who serves us. And in receiving that, of being the beneficiaries of that, that is how we are joined to him. See, the serving, this washing of the disciples' feet is a small picture of the greatest act of service that's ever been done. This washing of feet, Jesus lowering himself in this way, is a small picture of the greater way that Jesus will lower himself when he goes to the cross. That in a humiliating act, in Jesus going through something that seems so shameful, a painful, awful death, well, that is how we are joined to him. That is how we find life in him. I mean, we talk about it being humiliating, but I think the story helps us to understand the cross as well. It's not humiliating for Jesus. He lowers himself to wash the disciples' feet. He looks like a servant, this one who seems he shouldn't be doing this. Well, Jesus feels no shame in this moment. Jesus doesn't feel scorn. Jesus doesn't feel like he's losing anything in this time. He's willingly becoming a servant to give his disciples something they need. When Jesus goes to the cross, it looks like the ultimate picture of humiliation. He's being ridiculed. He's being scourged. He's being flogged. He's killed undeservedly. If anything looks humiliating, it's that. But the same Jesus who was willing to be a servant in chapter 13 is willing to be a servant, I should have looked it up ahead of time, in chapter 19, when he dies. The same Jesus who was the servant here is the same one who willingly lays down his life. He's not humiliated. What's the humiliation in the story then? It's for those who look on and say, this shouldn't be the way it's done. Where might we say that to Jesus? Jesus, who is this one deserving of all, who lowers himself. Jesus is this one who's so worthy of praise, helps to elevate other people. Jesus, as this one who does what we could not do, does exactly that. In times like that, we might be tempted to say, well, why can't it be some other way? We are people who like to have control over our lives, like to have say into it, like to believe that what you put into life, you will get out of it. That's not the way it works. And in Jesus, we're very much so confronted with that reality. Why can't I just do a work? Why can't I earn it for myself? No, Jesus says, I must do it for you. And if I do not serve you in this way, you have no part with me. Grace can be offensive. And yet it's in seeing Jesus lower himself, Jesus serve us in a way that we so desperately need that we cannot do. That's what causes us to realize who we truly are. That's what causes us to realize the impact of sin that's in our life. We're much more prone to downplay, to minimize, to say it's not a big deal. But when Jesus goes to the cross, we're confronted with how much of a big deal it is. That can feel humiliating. Jesus does this work that we're so desperate for that we could not do, that could feel humiliating. But it's only when we are served by him that we're joined to him. See, grace can feel embarrassing, humiliating. But when we taste the goodness of it, well, it overpowers everything else. When we recognize the mercy that it is that Jesus comes willingly to do what we so desperately need but could not. When we see the delight that it is that Jesus willingly goes to the cross to give us life in his name. When we recognize the beauty of Mark 10:45, that Jesus has come not to be served but to serve, we recognize that in him lowering himself, in him doing this what seems shameful act, in him doing what we're so desperate for, we find all that we need in him. See, Jesus chooses to wash his disciples' feet with all that's going on in his mind because it's a picture of what he does for all those who follow him. The only way that's possible is if you are a recipient of this grace, of him lowering himself, of him serving you. That's how you have a part with him. But the second reason why Jesus chooses to do this act is a bit more obvious. That's because it's specifically spelled out in the passage for us. Jesus washes his disciples' feet to show the type of work that he must do for all who are his disciples. But he also washes his disciples' feet as an example to them to do something similar. We pick it up in John 13, verse 12. It says, "When he had washed their feet and put on his outer garments and resumed his place, he said to them, 'Do you understand what I've done to you? You call me teacher and Lord, and you're right, for so I am. If then your Lord and teacher have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I've given you an example that you should also should do just as I have done for you. Truly, truly, I say to you that a servant is not greater than his master, nor a messenger greater than the one who sent him.'" See, what Jesus says is that I've washed the feet of my followers to show that all those who follow me are those who are served by me, but also that all those who follow me are to live in a similar way. In other words, Jesus as a servant shows us how we receive life and how we live life. How we receive life and how we live life. He says, "I've done this for you as an example. You call me Lord, you call me teacher, you affirm right things about me, and that's good, and that's true. But just as I have done for you, you are to do for others." See, no servant is greater than his master, and I'm sending you out to be servants. No messenger is greater than the one who sent me, and I'm sending you out to bring a message of what I've done to the world. You call me teacher, you call me Lord. Well, if I've been willing to do this for you, you are to do the same for others. I've given you this example. See, what Jesus says it looks like to follow him is to be someone who serves others. How we're to live our life now is to be done in looking to elevate other people just as he has done for us. Now he gives the example, as I've done for you, you are to do to others. And some people take that literally, that we need to be washing each other's feet. But it doesn't capture what's going on in the culture. It doesn't capture the mentality that Jesus is setting. He's calling people to serve in the way that he has, even if it's not literally in the way that it's been done. That's how the church has almost always understood this passage. But instead, he gives a picture of what service is to look like. And it shows that service is always something that comes at a cost. Service always comes at a cost. See, when Jesus washes his disciples' feet, well, that could cost him. He could lose face in the culture. It could bring shame on him. He could lose standing. He could lose respect of other people. That it's costly because it's disgusting work. There's probably other things that he would like to be doing. It's costly because it takes time. I mean, we are in the story on Thursday, and Jesus will go to the cross the next day. You think in the last remaining moments of his life that washing gross, disgusting feet is something that's way up there on the list. No, not at all. There's probably other things he could be doing with his time, but he pays the cost that this takes for a reason. Service is something that is costly. Service is also something that can feel shameful. That anytime we are looking to elevate other people and lower ourselves, that can feel like we're shaming ourselves, that we're seeing ourselves as insignificant, and that's not what it is. When we recognize that we are serving others, the emphasis is on exalting, lifting up others, not putting yourself down. That could always feel shameful, though, as we are saying in this culture where so often it is, you need to boast, you need to prove yourself, lie on that CV, whatever you can to prove that you are worthy. When Jesus shows, no, the way that you know that you're worthy is if you're willing to lift up others instead. That can feel shameful, but it's done to exalt others. And finally, service is something that's done indiscriminately. I mean, we're in here talking that Christians are to serve, and we probably walked in with at least some understanding like, yeah, that's true. That's what Christians are to do. And maybe as we think of the ways that we serve others, our mind goes to how we serve someone and they served us back. Or we serve people in our family, those that we're predisposed to want to do good things for. I mean, service is never easy, but our mind might go to those that are easier to serve than others. That's not the picture that's given to us. Where do I get that in the text? It's really fascinating that all throughout this passage where Jesus washes his disciples' feet, we're being reminded of something. Back in verse 2, we're reminded that that Satan had put it into Judas Iscariot's heart to betray Jesus. Verse 18, we're reminded that not all those who are with Jesus are truly with him, but one of them will go against Jesus, which we know to be Judas Iscariot. Sandwiching this story where Jesus washes his disciples' feet is this reminder that Judas is one of Jesus' disciples. What that means is that while they're all at this table watching as Jesus gets up, puts on the attire of a servant, and then goes up to Andrew and washes his feet. He does the same for James and John. And he goes up to Philip and Bartholomew. I don't know what the order is, but... And eventually he gets to Judas. And Jesus knows what Judas is about to do. We're told that. Judas knows what Judas is about to do. We're told that. And Jesus lays his hands on this one who's about to betray him. And gently and thoroughly washes his feet. See, the call is not just to serve those whom it's easy to do so. Not just to serve those that we might care about already. But it's to serve those who seek our harm, who seek to maim us, seek our ill. And we know that because Jesus chose to serve the greatest betrayer in the history of the world. Jesus, with all that is going on in his mind, all of the preamble of this story, chooses to wash his disciples' feet, to show that to be joined with him is to be served by him, but also to give an example of what our life looks like now. It's one that's marked by service, marked by looking for the good of others, even as it comes at a cost, even as it may feel shameful while we're exalting others, even while we might not want to help the people that we've been sent to help. It makes me think of the Apostle Paul in the book of Philippians. In chapter 1, there's this back and forth as to what would be best for me. Because if I was to die, I'd get to be with Jesus in glory, and that would be so great. But as I remain here, I get to be with these Christians that I care about. What would be best for me to do? And at the end of chapter 1, he lands on what almost acts as a motto, as a rule for life, what defines how he's going to be spending however many days he has left. And it, I think, works as well for us in the same way. How do we spend the time that we have? He says this in verse 25. He says, "Convinced of this, I know that I will remain and continue with you all." Why? And for what purpose? What is he going to do? "For your progress and joy in the faith." After this is the end of chapter 1. He goes into chapter 2, and it's this really beautiful passage of the humility of Jesus. He is God on high who lowers himself to be a servant. This one who's always worthy of glory, who lowers himself to become like us as a human, to join with us. It's almost as if that picture of Jesus' humility is what makes him land on this saying, "No, it's good for me to remain. It's good for me to stay. Much like my Savior, much like he is my example, I spend my time now looking at the progress and joy of others." What it means to be a follower of Jesus is to serve others, is to look around and ask the question, either out loud or just to ourselves, and respond in kind by saying, what needs to be done? What could I do that's a help to this person? What could I do that brings about their benefit? What can I do that produces joy in their life? How can I seek the progress and joy of others? Well, what does that actually look like in our lives? I mean, ultimately, you would know better than I would. I encourage you at some point today, maybe not this afternoon, you might be busy, but some point today to look through where are the different places in your life? What are the different hats that you wear? The different spots that God has you, because wherever you are, God has you in that spot. And think about within that role, within that position, within that place, how can I seek the progress and joy of others? Maybe I could cast a wide net and focus on a few areas that might be helpful for us. What does it look like to wash our spouse's feet? To seek service in our marriage? I mean, there's the literal place for this. I've been to weddings before where they have different special moments within the ceremony. Some people will mix sand. Some people will tie a cord of three strands. I've seen a bride and a groom wash each other's feet. It's this really beautiful picture of this is what we seek to do within this marriage. But always with marriage, I'm so delighted to be there. It's such a beautiful time, but I'm always much more interested in what's tomorrow going to look like, or a month from now, or 5 years. Less so when we're at a party, when joy has been building up to this moment. What is your marriage going to actually look like? How will you be washing each other's feet then? And I think one of the best ways that we can serve our spouse is by keeping what we promised on that wedding day. This is assuming that your officiant made sure that you had good vows. Because so often you hear like kind of sitcom-y vows where it's making a very small promise that's not really the basis of anything. I promise to always put the toilet paper on the right way. And that's not actually promising anything. I mean, we shouldn't be surprised that if the basis of someone's marriage is toilet paper, that it's so easy to get flushed down the drain. But if we have actual good vows, how are we keeping them? How are we serving each other in that way? Today and tomorrow and the next day and so on, I am choosing you over anyone else. I'm clinging to you no matter what. That I've joined my life to you, and while there's other things that may pull me in different directions, it is you that I've promised with. It is you that I serve. It is you that I cling to. That, yeah, circumstances might be difficult. We might go through hard times. That it may feel like there's plenty more moments of feeling poorer than richer, more sickness than health. And yet it's not choosing my preferences. It's not choosing an easier way out, but clinging to you in the midst of it. That's how I wash your feet every single day. I mean, there's plenty of things that make a marriage dissolve. But how many of those marriages don't just survive, but are strengthened when we recognize that's a place that we're called to serve as well? In our parenting, I mean, when am I not serving a needy, helpless creature? But what's my motivation behind it? This past week, we got a note from Everett's daycare that started off with the phrase, "We've been noticing some behaviors," and it made this panic arise within me. And it was looking back, like, well, why was I panicking then? And honestly, I think a part of it was, well, as he goes to daycare, he represents me. He shows something about how I parent him. And if this is not going the way that I think it ought to go, then he's showing that I'm not parenting the way that I ought to be. But is that the reason why I serve him? So I don't look bad? Or even as I'm called to lead him in life, how am I doing so in a way that serves him? Because I want him to know what grace and mercy feels like. When we're in conflict with someone, is our tendency to win, to make sure that we will feel vindicated on the other side of it, or to recognize I'm supposed to humble myself. I don't dominate here, but my role is to elevate others. When we're at work, it's easy to fall into power dynamics that's based off of our position, what our org chart says our value is. But it's recognizing that Christianity isn't just something that's supposed to exist on Sunday mornings when we're in a really nice and safe space. But wherever it is that we are is a place that God has you. And it's a place that you've been called to serve. What does it look like to serve within our workplace? Not because there's a paycheck associated with it, but because that's what we've been called to do in all of life. and extending hospitality. I mean, of all the things that Jesus could have chose to do in this story for his disciples, he chose to wash the disciples' feet. Is this picture of hospitality, of showing the value of someone, of saying that I am joining you to me. How do we use what we have been given to join other people to us? Hey, come over for a meal. Be with our family as if you are part of our family. We want you associated with us. We're not going to be a family that hides behind a closed door, but we want to use what we have to bring you in with us, to serve you. With the time that we have, to recognize that we've been given time on this world as a place to seek the good of other people, their progress and joy. Or instead is what our driving force is to get to those pauses, those breaks that we have, which we need. We all need rest and recovery. But is all that we're looking forward into the week, I just gotta get to Friday night. Man, I can't wait till Saturday. Sunday afternoon is when I finally get time to myself. I mean, if all we're looking for is times that we're away from other people, we're missing the fact that we can serve people with our time. And then finally, at least from what I have, you will have a better list. What about our comforts? The good things that are found in this world that bring us joy, vacations, time where there's a break, all of those are good things. But are we willing to lay down things that are good for something that's better? Because we're called to lift up others and shown that is a greater thing. Now, I recognize that there's probably one of two reactions that we might have whenever I get to something that's more practical. There's probably more than two reactions, but based off the time, we're just going to pretend like there's two reactions. One of them would be, yes, finally. Finally, he is calling out those people who sit on the sidelines. I mean, I've been plugging away. I've been pulling my weight, and all these other people are just freeloading. Finally, they're going to get onto this. That's not what Jesus is calling for here. There was a draft of this sermon where I had specific areas that I was going to direct us to as to where we could be serving, but it felt like it would take us in a direction that I don't think this passage is doing. It's not trying to show, here's where I need you. Here's some good places for you to go. We do have those, but the goal is not to fill a spot. The goal is not to fulfill a ministry. What we're being called to is a lifetime of seeking the service of others. So this passage is not about someone else. It's always about you and me. That what's being called to is a mentality that wherever it is that we are is a place that we seek to serve others. No matter what it is that we already are doing, the mindset is, what could I be doing to elevate other people? The point is not to look at our resume of what serving has looked like, but to recognize that all the days that we resume on this earth are done for the progress and joy of other people. Now, the other reaction is to look at that and feel crippled by it. I mean, there's already so much to do. There's already so much that fills my week. And now we're told that this is a mindset that we're always supposed to have. I'm always looking for opportunities. I'm always looking to serve. I mean, how do you keep that? How do you do that? It already feels like I can't do enough. But it's that reminder that Jesus does not give us this example because he really needs to get you on his team. And as he's washing Peter's feet, if I could just get Peter to do this for someone else, we're gonna start to have a movement on our hands. If I can get John to follow in, we're going to get the youth vote. It's going to go great. Jesus gives us this example because you need this example. Going back to chapter 12, verse 25. Whoever loves his life loses it, and whoever hates his life in this world will keep it for eternal life. If anyone serves me, he must follow me. And where I am, there will my servant be also. If anyone serves me, the Father will honor him. I mean, what is it that helps us to not put all of our hope in this life that we have right now? What is it that helps us to not become too attached to things that are good in this world but are fleeting? What is it that enables us to prioritize things that don't take us down a path that will end up with us losing our life? What coaches our hearts to love things that matter? Well, it's to live this life that Jesus sets for us. To live this life that's done in response to him. Because the timing of this story matters so much. Jesus washes his disciples' feet. Jesus is the one who humbles himself. Jesus is the one who serves. Jesus is the one who will ultimately go onto the cross. And it's in light of that, he says, this is an example. It's in light of what he has already done that he drives out, gives the possibility to live out in a similar way. In light of his great love, we then live lives that reflect that love to this world. See, whenever we're overwhelmed by that, just feels like it's too much. How do we do this all the time? That just doesn't feel possible. Whenever we're overwhelmed by what there is to do, reflect instead on what's already been done for you. See, we look at the lavish love of Jesus in his example, but we look at how he's given that example, not just to you, not just for you, but how he's done it for you. Charles Spurgeon, in reflecting on this chapter, pauses right at the beginning to just look at the lavish love of Jesus, because it's only when we have that rightly ordered, when we look at what Jesus has done, how he has loved you, that is what makes this life possible. So he begins by just looking at the extent of how Jesus loves his people. He wrote this. He said, he will love his people to the utmost end of their unloveliness. Their sinfulness cannot travel so far, but what his love will travel beyond it. Their unbelief even shall not be extended to so great a length, but what his faithfulness shall still be wider and broader than their unfaithfulness. He will never suffer one of his chosen to fall in such deadly sin or go so far as that he cannot yet outstrip even the strides which his iniquities may have taken. In short, I love this. He says, if our sins be mountains, his love shall be like Noah's flood, and the tops of the mountains shall be covered. Not so much as a sin shall be found against us. See, it's that which produces a mentality that looks around and asks, what can I be done? What can be done? I mean, yes, there's always going to be more things to do. I mean, even Jesus, in this example that he gives to us, he washes 12 guys' feet. It's not because they were the only 12 dudes with bad feet in Israel. There will always be more things to do. But instead, he is creating this mindset, creating this mentality that serving is being better than being served. Elevating others is better than being elevated. Humbling ourselves practices a mentality that is set on eternity rather than what's fleeting. Chapter 13 is the beginning of what's called the farewell discourse. Jesus essentially saying goodbye as he's going to the cross. It's, so to speak, his last opportunity with his disciples to show what he's about to do, what the purpose of it is, and what life will look like when he's no longer face-to-face with his followers. And the first thing he says, the very first thing that he emphasizes of what life looks like is humility and service. I mean, all of that preamble, all of this going on in his mind, all of the richness that happens in the first three verses of John 13, all of that as the background, with Jesus knowing what is happening, well, he gives almost a simple definition as to what it looks like to follow him, what it looks like to be his disciple. And it's that Christians serve. Christians seek the progress and joy of others just as our progress, our good, our joy has been established for us. We serve just as we have been served.